The Healthy Insights podcast features conversations with the leading minds in the field of health and well-being. Our hope is for you to gain insights, learn something new, and discover some valuable takeaways from our fascinating group of guests. Host Jim Narum is a respected leader with over 30 years of experience in the employee health and well-being field. The Healthy Insights podcast is brought to you by Asset Health, a comprehensive health and well-being services and technology provider. Asset Health's approach is based on actively cultivating the idea that your health is your most valuable asset.
Hello and welcome. This is Jim Narum, your host of the Healthy Insights podcast. My co-host for this episode is Chris Sullivan, Director, Marketing and Strategic Initiatives at Asset Health. This episode's guest is Andrew Davies, CEO of iCast World, which recently became a Lyra Health company. iCast World is a global provider of employee assistance programs and a Global Steps Challenge. Want to know more about global EAP and how multinational companies are using EAP to support their employees? This episode is for you. iCast World currently delivers a consistently high level of service through its network of 43 regional offices and strategic partners covering over 185 countries, spanning six continents, and supporting 2,400 companies and their millions of members. In our conversation with Andrew, he shares a little bit about his upbringing in his home country of South Africa, early work as a clinical psychologist, and what led him to pursue his current career. Andrew also shares some of the challenges of running a global business and what it takes to deliver culturally sensitive and effective EAP care in so many countries. Andrew received his academic training in South Africa, including his Bachelor of Arts degree in Social Science, Bachelor of Arts degree in Applied Psychology, and his Master of Arts in Clinical Psychology. He also completed the Executive Education Program from the Wharton School in association with AXA University. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you join us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And Chris, welcome, and thanks for co-hosting this episode.
Yeah, I'm excited and happy to be on another one. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Well, let's do it. So Andrew, you're the CEO of iCast World and have worked with for iCast for a total of 22 years. Tell us more about iCast, your company.
It's an interesting story, Jim. So iCast was founded by Dr. Michael Reddy in the UK in 1987. Interestingly, Dr. Reddy had spent most of his life as a Jesuit priest, but he and during that time he had spent time studying psychology in the US, where he saw the psychological profession playing an active role in the corporate world. That was quite different to the situation in his home country of the UK, where psychological services were largely restricted to the government, to the National Health Services. So he left the priesthood and he founded the first employee assistance program in the UK, which was called ICAS, and it stands for the Independent Counseling and Advisory Services. Half my staff get that wrong because everyone uses the acronym. but over the next decade, the company grew to become the largest provider of organizationally focused employee support services in the UK. And then in 1997, ICAS made a decision to expand beyond the borders of the UK. And that was driven by clients like British Airways that said, look, you look after our staff here, but we have staff all over the world. They fly everywhere. So how about, looking beyond that? And so it made this decision in 1997 to expand beyond those borders and to embark on the development of its global footprint. And I suppose we haven't looked back since. We've spent the last 20 years developing our capacity to deliver EAP services on a global scale. And I think we've learned a tremendous amount over the last two decades. Perhaps our most important learning now sits at the center of our approach, and in many ways it defines who we are as an organization. And I suppose that is that we've learned that to provide truly effective EAP services with good outcomes, services have to be delivered at a local level. And by services, I first and foremost mean clinical services, but I also mean client services, training services, organizational consulting services. So it's been quite a journey from its humble beginnings in the UK to where we are now as a global service provider.
And so how many countries and members served does ICAST have now? Because I know there's a lot.
Yeah. So we look after about 2,400 multinational organizations, and the staff complement of those means that we cover about 4.5 million lives, and that includes their dependents. So it's I always like to say 4.5 million families, and that's in 165 countries. So it's certainly quite a comprehensive footprint.
Backing up a little bit, you grew up in South Africa.
Yes.
And before ICAST, you were a clinical psychologist.
Yeah.
working with victims of trauma primarily that experienced detention and torture at the hands of the apartheid government in South Africa.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about what you realized with employee assistance programs and you know, the ability to provide that psychological support to people on a large scale basis. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, great. So one of the difficulties about growing up in a developing world economy is the difficulties that exist in the broader healthcare infrastructure. So whether that's my home country like South Africa, it could be other developing world economies such as Mexico, for example, doesn't really matter. But you've got, firstly, a huge disparity between rich and poor. And you've got major problems in your service delivery infrastructure, healthcare being one of them. So psychological services are not widely available. Most people don't have access to them, and those that do have access to them often don't have access to appropriate, affordable services. And that's the difficulty. So as an individual, as much as I really felt that the work that I was doing was meaningful and met a need, it was always on a small scale. And being exposed to the EAP field helped me to realize that essentially its main aim was to cover a large number of belly buttons. That's really about scale. And that's what appealed to me. So, we could provide services on a much larger scale. And that's when I started ICAST in 1987. And we've grown that business to be able to provide services to 2 million people. And those are good clinical services. And those people would otherwise not have access to any of those services. And for me, that was a really meaningful part of my career, is to do things on a much larger scale and in a more meaningful way.
Talk a little bit about your upbringing. You shared some information about your upbringing, and its role in developing kind of character, your character and your values.
Yeah.
that kind of influenced your career choice and the work that you do today.
Okay, so I grew up, as I said, in South Africa. I was the second of five children. My father was an accountant by profession, but also an Olympic athlete, so very, very, very driven.
Wow.
And my mother was an artist. We were raised in a reasonably strict Presbyterian home. And so there was a strong sense of fairness and social justice that was embedded in all of us from quite an early age. And I think growing up in South Africa, where there was a huge amount of social injustice, that played a very formative role in the kind of work that I wanted to do, rather than following in my father's footsteps and becoming an accountant or an engineer or something along those lines. I felt that I wanted to make a difference, to be some sort of an agent of social change, I suppose a bit idealistic. But that's really why I chose psychology as a profession. It's a helping profession. And that's when I decided, once I had qualified, to spend time working with essentially with victims of the apartheid system on both sides of that divide. So a lot of people that had been in detention and torture. I also worked for 5 years in a children's home. So a lot of that was really about trauma, whether it was childhood trauma or adult trauma. That's kind of the first part of my career.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because I think that that gives a sense of, you know, where you came from, but it's really also continues to drive you today.
It does.
Yeah, that's an amazing background and story to hear that. Andrew, you mentioned the importance of delivering service at a local level.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, what does wellness and well-being mean globally, and does it differ from place to place? And really, how important is it to understand and factor in local culture, local customs, when deploying such a large international employee wellness solution?
So it's a great question. I think there are two things that I want to highlight there, that it's always important not only to talk about differences but similarities. Sometimes we focus too much in this world, I think, on how we're different, and that causes unnecessary conflict. Yeah. And not always on what we have in common. You know, I think fundamentally we all have in common that people are good. But it is important to recognize the differences that exist in different parts of the world and how that impacts the way in which we seek help and the way in which we provide help. And one of the challenges in running a global program, particularly when it comes to mental health, and I would say to some extent health in general, is that you need to take cognizance of the local environment. You know, context matters. And what I mean by that is that if you're providing psychological support, for example, for someone who may be having relationship problems or they're depressed, you need to understand that person in the context of where they live and how they live, what resources are available. So sometimes people think about that purely from a language point of view. So yes, if I'm speaking to somebody in Spain, I need to make sure that I'm speaking Spanish so we understand one another. And language is absolutely critical. But more importantly than that is an understanding of culture. You need to understand that person's world. You need to not only understand their language or be able to communicate them with them, but what is the local national healthcare infrastructure? So what do they have access to? If they've developed a substance abuse problem, are there rehabilitation facilities available? Will their medical insurance or the national health system cover that? What is the local political environment? What is the religious environment? So if you're dealing with someone in a Sharia law country, what does that actually mean? And these are the factors that you need to take into consideration if you really want to provide help. And so as an organization, one of the things that Michael Reddy really instilled in all of us that I've certainly taken to heart is that context matters. And when we developed our local infrastructure, well, our global infrastructure, it wasn't to centralize it. It was to localize it. So some providers in our industry provide everything out of a call center in Oxford in the UK or Texas and, you know, have translation services. Our approach was to say, if we're providing services to someone in Argentina, we need to ensure that the person that's providing that care lives in that country, understands that environment, and can provide the kind of help they need. And for us, that produces a better quality of care. I hope that makes sense, Chris.
It does make sense, and that was really insightful. My understanding is that in many countries across the globe, such as South Africa, but many others, mental health services are limited and demand greatly exceeds supply, and many local governments can't meet the need.
Yeah.
Could you share some facts or some stats or information about this global need for EAP and for well-being solutions that you're company is solving for?
Well, firstly, there's a very clear and obvious increase in the need for mental health services in general. And that's been accelerated by COVID-19. Right. And I use the word accelerated because COVID-19 didn't create that. It the demand predated the pandemic by a number of years. There were some earlier drivers that I think have been overshadowed by the pandemic. So we saw the proliferation of social media, for example. The younger generations who tend to use that social media prolifically became more inclined, or as a generation culturally, the world over are more inclined to talk about mental health issues, to be more open about them. We then saw things like the social justice movements, the Me Too movement, and then celebrities, I think very importantly, embracing mental health and stigma associated with it, in a challenging stigma. So in the US, people like Michael Phelps and Lady Gaga, you've got even Kanye West and Kendrick Lamar. And then in the UK, people like the princes, Prince Harry, all talking about the mental health challenges that they had. And I think that's had a profound impact on helping to address stigma, helping to encourage people to talk about the mental health and emotional challenges that they have. So this is what started that. And then I think COVID-19 thrust us all into the situation where our emotional well-being was seriously challenged. And so that's where it kind of was accelerated. So I think that's really an important one. So to answer your question more specifically in terms of stats, the World Health Organization, according to them, depression costs the global economy over $1 trillion a year. And this is just one form of mental illness. So if you combine it with things like substance abuse disorders, anxiety disorders, or your neurocognitive disorders such as dementia, for example, it's certainly going to be even higher than that. So a massive cost. And sadly, I think we live in a world where more than half the world's population, again, according to global statistics, don't have access to mental health care at all, whatsoever. And as I said earlier, for those who do have access, the help is either very costly or it's inappropriate, or it's difficult to access. Pre the pandemic, in the corporate world, where we work, only 42% of global employees have not just an EAP program, but a global well-being strategy in place. And this is one of the big changes we've seen. So it's changing rapidly, and mental health in the workplace is becoming a priority, I think, for all business leaders. Again, in terms of stats, we've seen a 44% increase in the issuing of global EAP tenders over the last 3 years. So the growth in demand is not, very importantly, is not restricted to your more developed world economies, such as in North America and Europe. But we've also seen that across Latin America, the Asia Pacific region as well. And then if you just look at it from a pure economic point of view, the global behavioral health market is growing exponentially. It's predicted to enjoy an 11% compound annual growth rate over the next 5 years. So it's certainly there's a lot of evidence to support the massive move towards growth in demand in the sector.
That's great, and thank you for diving into the mental health and how the mental health issues and how the pandemic has accelerated a lot of those trends that were already in place. I was definitely pondering that. So you work with many sophisticated multinational organizations. I'm curious, what are some of the common challenges when deploying a global effort like that? And have any of those challenges been exacerbated by the pandemic? And if you'd like, you can share a specific ICAS client success story that you're proud of, where you had some challenges and you were able to kind of overcome those and achieve some positive results.
Sure. So I'll start with a success story, which I think is exacerbated by, or has been exacerbated by the changes in the world recently, but is not related specifically to that. We look after a client in the banking sector. It has about 45,000 employees. Situated largely in developing world economies in Asia, in Latin America, and in Africa. And they're a traditional bank with a very large branch network. And as a result of where those branches are, they experience a high number of bank robberies, of cash in transit heists. And they've relied very heavily on us to provide critical incident support when these incidents occur. So we've really partnered with them strongly to help them recover from these traumatic incidents. Some of the incidents are very violent and traumatic, and I'm incredibly proud of the fact that we're able to respond within hours to an incident and provide the necessary support regardless of which country that person is in. And some of those branches are in places where if it rains, it's kind of difficult to reach the branch. But in addition to that support, we've then provided psychological first aid, trauma management training to branch managers. So we've tried to empower them and their ability to manage these incidents more effectively. And I think that's an important part of health and well-being. We see so strongly in our partnership with Asset Health, it's not just about providing care, it's about empowering people to take responsibility for their own health and well-being and to help others. So being able to provide that kind of training to line managers so they can become first responders, and that they can take on the skills that we impart is I think very meaningful and rewarding for me, and goes back to kind of my primary purpose in life that we spoke about earlier. And then to bring that closer to you to what you had said about the impact of the pandemic. So because of the pandemic, there have been major changes to the way in which we all live and transact, and I'm sure everyone's aware of that in the banking industry. So 2 years ago, the bank sort of started this journey of a major digital transformation, and they needed to move essentially from a traditional bricks and mortar bank to a more digital bank. And this involved a massive restructuring exercise and the closure of a large number of branches. And again, because these branches are in these developing world economies where you have high incidence of unemployment, etc., it really had a profound impact on the health and well-being of employees. So once again, the bank relied quite heavily on us to provide emotional and practical support to those that were impacted by the change. And I think the bank was able to demonstrate that although it had made a tough decision in order to survive and compete, it understood the impact that it had on the health and well-being of employees, and it took meaningful steps to exercise that duty of care responsibility. So it's a nice example of me because it illustrated the partnership, it illustrated how critical employee health and well-being is becoming, not only to a duty of care, but also ultimately to the functioning of an organization. It's not just a tears and tissue welfare type of issue. It also makes a meaningful difference to their ability to perform and compete in a global world.
Andrew, what are some global EAP trends and maybe opportunities that you see going forward?
Okay, there are a number of them, but perhaps let me try and discuss the top few. The first trend is towards a different means of access. And again, I'll use a banking analogy. If you remember, I suppose 20 years ago, if you and I wanted to do some banking, we would drive into town, go to our local branch. We would have to do it during office hours. We would queue. We would wait our turn, then speak to the teller, touch the money, feel the money, and go, that's how we would bank. That was then replaced by telephone banking, where you didn't have to go into town. You could pick up the phone and speak to a person and ask them to do a transaction for you or get your balance or whatever it might be. And then it was online banking. And nowadays, it seems to be in-app banking. So you can bank at 12 o'clock at night and do all of, meet all of those needs. And I think that's it might seem a bit off topic, but it's exactly what we're seeing in the EAP industry, where the way in which people access these kind of services is what's changed fundamentally. Historically, in EAP, people really sought services originally just in a face-to-face format, normally on-site, and then telephonically. But now what we're seeing is that because of the differences in the way in which we all live and learn and socialize and seek help, we need to, the EAP industry needs to adjust to that. So we've seen a increase in demand, not only for voice, and voice is not just the traditional telephone, it's really through your mobile devices, video, live chat, online. So there's a diversity, and that needs to be available on a 24/7 basis. So the role of technology and different ways of accessing help, ultimately might be quite similar, psychological support from a registered psychologist, but how it's delivered and when it's, how accessible it is, I think is the first major change that we're seeing in the industry. And that's also akin to what you're probably seeing on the physical health side with the growth of teledoc services. People always used to go in and see their doctor. Now they also are sometimes happy to phone their doctor or have a video consult. So parallel to that. The second one is towards self-help, and people want to be able to access real-life professional help in the way in which they always have, to have their needs met. But they also want to access relevant content themselves. So if, let's say somebody is struggling to sleep, for example. They historically, the only avenue they had was to go and see someone. They might now, as people have become more technologically literate, they might say, well, first of all, let me Google that, or let me try and get some help on what might the problem be. Are there any self-help tools? So can I do a little sleep hygiene check, or can I do a little meditation course that's going to help me to sleep? So another part of that is, is there sort of self-help content? And that's not in place of, it's often in addition to. So they often say nowadays, the first person that we consult when we're physically ill is Dr. Google. We kind of Google our symptoms and then we might go to the doctor. And I think psychologically it's the same thing. I'm struggling with this. Let me see what I can access. What can I get in addition to that? And that's where the role of technology is becoming increasingly important. If you provide, you don't just want to provide care, you want to make sure that that's it's reputable support. And that's where we've seen the emergence of apps like Calm, for example, because they help to fulfill that need. The third move, I think, is towards a broader, more progressive definition of health and well-being, where one's emotional health and physical health are not separate and distinct. So EAPs and wellness programs are starting to come together to provide more holistic and comprehensive care for employees. And this is where our partnership with Asset Health is so important and complementary to me. That, when you talk about your health, your emotional health is as important as your financial health, as your relationship health, as your physical health. They're not distinct and separate categories. And so I think organizations are realizing that these, if we really want effective programs, that they all need to kind of merge and come together. And the more you separate out something as loaded as psychological help, the more difficult it becomes. The more you normalize it as part of your overall health, the better that is. So that's an exciting trend. So I'd say those are kind of the top three that we're seeing that are kind of revolutionizing the industry.
That's great and really helpful. So Andrew, I'm going to shift gears back to something a little more personal. Yeah. You live in a place of great natural beauty and lead an active life. What are some of your favorite things to do to maintain your own personal health and well-being?
Okay. Thank you for that. Sometimes I think it's a question of do as I say, not as I do. Because I don't always practice what I preach as well as I would like to. But having said that, I try hard to lead as simple a life as possible. I think to focus on four meaningful things that give my life a sense of purpose. And they are firstly my family, to always try and make time for family or spend time for family, no matter how busy I am. I find it very restorative and rejuvenating. The second one is what you touched on, which is physical activity, and that's really to try and exercise regularly, and that's not to be a world class sportsman. It's just to make sure that I do some exercise, and that's sort of linked to the next one, which is maintaining my connection to the natural world. So it could be simple things like walking my dogs or hiking in the bush or visiting a reserve, really just to have that connection with nature. And then the final one, I think, is I don't know how to term it, kind of giving back, which is, I suppose, for me, usually takes the form of mentoring and supporting those that are less fortunate than myself. I find that no matter how busy I am, if I find meaning in what I do, then I seem to have an unlimited amount of energy. And so kind of the balance between those, I think, gives me strength and helps to keep me going.
Very helpful. So Andrew, one of the things that I like to ask all our guests on the podcast are, what are three takeaways from our conversation today that you would want our listeners to, if they remembered nothing else, what would those three takeaways be from this episode?
I'd say the first one is that mental health in the workplace is growing in prominence and is now an important part of a company's duty of care responsibility. It needs to be taken seriously, and it really shouldn't be be ignored. It's not just about, as I said, a tears and tissue responsibility. It makes a significant difference to the overall performance of a business. So that would be the first. The second is for EAPs to be effective, they must be easily accessible via multiple channels, and they must be locally relevant and appropriate. It's one thing to have a program, to have an effective program is a different one. And for me, that's really a core component of it. And the third one is that the distinction between your traditional EAPs and health and wellness programs is becoming more blurred with the dawning realization that they're intricately linked. So I think corporates need to ensure that their programs recognize this and they're able to optimize their effectiveness. Those are the three that I would like people to take out.
Those are three really good ones. And I think that captures our conversation just perfectly. Thank you so much for being a guest. This has been terrific, and we do value the partnership. But it's always good to hear a little more about your background, and it always gives context to understand what drives you and each and every day that you get up.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andrew, so much for the great insights. And I came in wondering about, you know, what are the differences globally in terms of health and well-being, but I'm leaving with a newfound appreciation for a lot of the similarities. We're all human beings, and we all share so much on a psychological and emotional level. So
thank you. Well, perhaps if we've got just a minute or two, I can just expand on that last point, Chris. Great.
We do.
Because I
we
think
do.
That COVID, totally. I know we touched on it. It's a really nice way of illustrating exactly what we've been talking about. People's response to the virus is influenced and mediated by a combination of factors. And they may be specific to an individual. So, you know, your health status, you might have some comorbidities, for example. It might be your age or your support network, whatever it is. But they also are contextual. So, you know, is there an available healthcare infrastructure? What is the trust in government? What sort of support is available? And I think COVID is just a great example because it's the same virus. I know they're different variants, but it's the same virus regardless of where you are in the world. And what we all have in common and what we've seen in our mm-hmm. program is everyone had experienced fear and anxiety about the about the virus. Would I get ill? Might I land up in hospital? Might I lose someone that's close to me? That's kind of a universal. The second one is social isolation. In most parts of the world, people had to isolate in a way that they never had to before. They weren't able to go to the workplace. Kids weren't able to go to school. And again, there were huge challenges that were universal in what people experienced. Remote working is part of that. In almost every part of the world, people had to work remotely. And there are a host of challenges associated with that, particularly when you're not in great circumstances. Homeschooling, another example there. Many people experience loss and bereavement, either directly to a colleague or family member, and a huge amount of frustration and fatigue on the extent to which this virus impacted people's lifestyle and the way in which they lived, and that kind of uncertainty. So there's a huge amount of similarity, regardless of whether you're in the bottom of Africa or the top of Europe, that those were in common. But there are also differences. So in certain parts of the world, I know in my home country of South Africa, more people were killed by security forces during the first lockdown than by the virus itself. Whether you've got a stable environment, there were some people in a number of countries that targeted Asian nationals because they felt it was the China virus, and huge discrimination and victimization. There are a number of countries where the governments were not strong enough to be able to sort of step in and provide economic support for people who lost income, whereas there are others, particularly those in Central Europe with strong governments that provided grants, etc., that helped people going. So They're huge differences. There were some countries that had a massive and effective national healthcare structure that had you know, sufficient beds and oxygen. There were others like India, I remember, that ran out of oxygen. There was, you know, the healthcare system wasn't able to cope with the crisis. There are 8 countries in Africa that don't have a single ventilator. So, you know, if you get sick, what's going to happen to you? So the kind of challenges and the kind of support that we're able to provide are going to differ, and you need to take that into consideration. So it illustrates that we have a lot in common wherever we are, but there are also some differences. And if we can take both of those into consideration, then that's really what we need to do in today's world. Sorry, I'm rambling a bit.
I think it's very insightful, and I think the you know what it really says is that every really looking at things on a global basis and understanding that one country's situation, one area of a country is different than another country. And it's really important to take a global view and then provide resources as you described that ICAS provides, understands that at a local level and provides that. And that, you can't really make a lot of generalizations on care. So thank you very much for being a guest. This
thank
has
you.
Been
it's
fabulous.
A pleasure and we appreciate it. I do appreciate the invitation.
Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app or player. We also encourage you to rate this podcast. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.